Hey, Wayne.
Yes, Steve.
I don't want us to get too big of a head here, but
you think? Yeah.
Two episodes in, and
we're huge.
What's
we're
huge?
A success.
What's huge?
Raid the Light Theater.
The podcast.
Oh, so good that
See,
time.
See, I remembered it that
yeah,
time.
Yeah, really did.
Episode two, for those who didn't tune in to the Wilmer Flores episode,
and
first of
should.
All, do it.
Yeah.
Second of all, I kept forgetting to end Randolay Theater
you know,
with
don't
the
even
podcast.
Tell them that, because
no,
they
okay.
should know that. These are our loyal listeners.
Yeah.
And obviously it's working. They are listening. They're rating us. They're reviewing us. And we're one of the best podcasts of all time, I think.
Wow.
I saw that in the rating.
You were very, very excited when you saw
it. Were you not as excited?
No, I was excited, but... Yeah. The text message I got from Wayne, everybody,
yeah.
Was that it just said, oh, my God. I think
yeah.
that's what it
Something
said.
Like that.
Something
yeah.
like that. And I said, what? I actually went to Twitter and thought yeah. something happened
oh,
in the baseball world.
Yeah.
yeah. I had no idea what you were referring to.
Sure.
And then you said we are ranked in the top 200 mm-hmm. sports and recreation podcasts,
right.
which... You know, I don't really know how many sports and recreation podcasts there are. So while I'm happy about it...
There's 200 that just follow the Mets.
Is that true?
I mean, but there are a lot.
Okay, well, I trust yeah. you, but we're number 176 as of the taping of this podcast.
Right.
I hope when people listen to this podcast,
yeah.
maybe we're a little bit higher.
Sure.
But that's great.
Yeah.
I just, you know, I don't want to rest on my laurels here.
We were ahead of some big names.
Okay, that's fine, but I'm
just
shooting.
Saying.
I'm shooting higher, okay?
Yeah.
There's 175 in front of us, and I don't like that.
Yeah.
Okay, that's how I look at it.
Back after this.
But.
Behind.
Wow. Well, a little bit of a different format. But we do want to thank everybody because you guys have been awesome with the feedback, and we're having fun with this, and we'll keep bringing it to you. Wayne, do you want to tell the people what happened today? Why are you laughing so much? You got a couple producers in the room right now?
There are some producers
yeah.
here. There are always people around us.
Right, and I think one of them is, you know, making you laugh here.
No.
No?
I'm laughing because he's laughing, but he's laughing because of what I said.
Okay. All right. Yeah. Anyway, what happened today?
Oh, yeah. Today we played in the media softball game, which sounds like it's just us playing each other, but in reality...
Well, it was media versus front office.
Media versus front
game.
Office. And the Mets front office consists of former professional baseball players. Eric Langel, who's bullpen catcher, played in pro ball for the Mets.
He did.
Jim Kelly didn't play pro ball, I don't
no,
think.
He played
but
Dartmouth.
He played Dartmouth. It was
yeah.
D1. Mm-hmm. And Donovan Mitchell Sr., important to note because his son's a better athlete than him now, played all the way
he
up
played
to
Triple A.
And then there was Ricky Bonus, who was a major league pitcher, but still.
So, but you're, listen, you're burying the lead. You're making the excuses before. We can just,
yeah.
we can be
we
out.
Lost.
We have to be honest.
We
lost, and we lost big.
Of course we did.
We lost big. We lost by 12 runs.
16-4.
Yeah. It wasn't our best day, and I had high
right.
hopes for us because I thought we kept it close last year.
We did.
And, you know, I had the off-season surgery really with an eye on August.
Yeah.
On August to finally.
You had the surgery in January.
Right, but it was with an
right.
eye. I wanted it to be
right.
100%. You know,
right.
you don't know what the timetable was going to be. It was actually
not.
A lot longer than they'd originally told me. So if
right.
I would have had the surgery.
That happens.
You know, it does happen, but I wouldn't have been prepared for today, which might have been a better thing. Despite
no.
You don't think so?
No.
I had an amazing batting practice.
Right.
Tell
you
the
did.
People about my batting
no,
practice.
No, you hit some lasers in batting
lasers
practice.
Lasers in batting
yeah.
practice. But I went 0 for 4 in the game.
You did. Did not hit a laser in the game.
No, I had an error, which
yeah.
I thought it was a little bit
Everybody
of home scoring.
Everybody had an error.
Yeah. You did something bizarre.
Well, it was bizarre in hindsight, but I had a whole thing. So, first of all, Carlos, who is the interpreter for the Spanish-speaking players, hit a triple, but really it was a ball that should have been caught.
Mm-hmm.
Our friend Anthony DiComo came
he
in.
He had a bad day, too.
Yeah, he did. He came in, the ball was over his head, it was a triple. So then the next batter hit a rocket right back to the pitcher, but because he was pitching, it wasn't on the grass, he was pitching on this little raised platform, so it hit the bottom of the platform and then it went bounced up.
Yeah.
So he tried to grab it, and he missed it. And then I tried to grab it, and I missed it. But I was able to reach it with my bare
well,
hand.
Well, you were flailing about on the ground.
I was on
Let's
the ground.
Not, you didn't
yeah.
try and reach it from a ready position.
Well,
you were not in an athletic
because it
position.
Was,
you were
no, I was
rolling
not.
Around on
because
the ground.
Because it was just like this ball suddenly had, like, jelly all over. Uh-huh. Nobody could pick it up. So I thought I could still get Carlos out at home.
You couldn't. He was not.
So
he
I was
about
flat
a foot
on
away.
My back, uh-huh. and I threw it. And the ball obviously went haywire.
You flew, I mean,
yeah.
you threw that ball halfway up the first baseline.
Yeah,
that
it was halfway between first and home.
And then it put us yeah. in a bad spot, to
no,
be honest
that,
with
that
you.
That next runner didn't score.
I didn't say that we didn't get out of it. I said it put us in a bad spot.
Yeah, but that was fine.
You also, by the way,
yeah.
we had a little mix-up at second and short, the two of us, obviously.
Well, it was a double play chance.
And the ball hit off your glove and hit me in the chest.
Yeah, because the catcher threw it, and I couldn't quite reach it, so it hit off the tip of my glove, and it killed you.
When we came in today,
Jacob
DeGrom got after me, because apparently this is spreading now that I went
really,
over four.
Everybody knows.
It's spreading around like I was the worst player on the field, when in actuality, I was one of our better players. We were just across the board pitiful.
Right. It was an awful showing from everybody.
Right. But so Jacob DeGrom came after me, and he said to us, see, now you can't ask us, you know, about our
card.
And I said, me. And I said, when have we asked you one negative thing this year?
Right,
Jacob DeGrom, right?
Jacob.
Noah Syndergaard just, I mean, trashed me. Just absolutely trashed me. And Eric Langille actually came up and did a mock interview with me, really trying to make me uncomfortable. So
I don't remember him getting many hits, by the way.
No.
It was
Kelly.
It was Mitchell. It was
Ricky Bonus.
No,
he wasn't a part of it.
Langille didn't do anything.
No. So anyway, rough one, and it's going to take a little while to come back from. But you know
what? Well, I got a whole year to get better.
What doesn't kill you makes you stronger.
That's right.
Motivation.
I'll be motivated.
Pretty sore, though, right now. How you feel?
Yeah, well, I feel fine. I don't get sore. But you do. You... You really have a hard time bouncing back physically from things, I feel like.
Maybe I just put it all out there.
There was one play where Aaron, who is Tony's intern for MLB.com, threw the ball in from the outfield to second base, and you twisted up in a way I've never seen, like in a cartoon way.
But I made the play.
You were going to your left, you twisted back to your right, you caught the ball, but it was just, you ended up with your arms around yourself and your legs were all up in the air. It was crazy.
I made the play.
Yeah, but you're paying for it.
I made the play, but my back is killing me right now. So, what are you going to do? The price you pay for glory.
or whatever
or
we did.
Or losing by 12.
Yeah.
We do have a podcast today with
we have
a guest.
Yeah,
we have a guest. And I'll let you intro this guest because it's not one of the current players. And this is what did we say for our loyal listeners, first episode ever, is that it's
episode
going to be
zero.
The Mets sphere.
That's right.
And you found that funny, but it is. It's going to be the Mets sphere. It's not just current players, but some former players as well.
And we are talking to a former player. Ed Lynch was a part of the Mets in the 80s, just as they were getting good. He was a part of some of those bad teams in the early 80s and played for George Bamberger, the whole thing. And then he was on the team when Davey Johnson took over as manager and the Mets started to become a legitimate contender. The problem for Ed is that in the middle of 1986, the guy gets traded to the Chicago Cubs, who were certainly not in contention that year, and he kind of missed the whole party in the second half of that season. But Ed did go on to become a Major League General Manager for the Cubs. He scouted for many, many years, so he's a guy who's maybe an old-school guy that we feel like you should get to know a little better.
You usually say roll the tape. I'm going to take that from you because that was such a good intro. So, Ed Lynch, roll the tape. Well, Ed, we appreciate this, man. Really excited to do this. And, I mean, we've got so much to delve into with you. You've played so many different roles in the game of baseball. But let's just take it from the beginning. When you come up to the Mets, 1980, you were part of those teams early on. Those were some really rough seasons. So as a young player, what is that like to, you know, A, come up in that spot where you're obviously trying to establish just yourself as a player, but you've also got to work against a team that's just struggling to compete, really?
Yeah, it was a strange dynamic. You know, I'm a native New Yorker. My whole family's from Brooklyn. I lived in New York till I was 12 years old, and we moved to Florida. So just to be in the big leagues with the Mets was an unbelievable thrill. I mean, we could have been 0-100, and as a young player, I was just so thrilled to put on the uniform. But those were some tough times, some bad clubs, and I remember coming up, and I think my first relief appearance in a pro game was in the big leagues. I had never pitched out of the bullpen, and I remember Joe Torre sent me down to the bullpen. I pitched an inning on the day I came up, gave up 4 runs in San Francisco. I did not pitch for 13 days, and we lost 13 games in a row.
Oh, my goodness.
So finally, after about the 10th game, I went into Joe's office and said, Joe, am I ever going to pitch again? And he says, you're pitching Saturday against the Cubs. So I started on Saturday, September 13th, after pitching on August 29th, and I won. So I won my first start. So that was obviously a big thrill, but it's really amazing the change that club made in such a short period of time. Yeah. And I think Frank Cashin, Fred Wilpon had a lot to do with that and deserve a bulk of the credit. We went from doormats to In 1984, we won 90 games. We won 98 games in 85. And then, they won the World Series in 86. I was traded in June of that year. So to answer your question, I was happy to be there. By 1983, it was starting to get old, losing.
Yeah.
As a guy who became a GM yourself, how do you look back at Frank Cashin and see how his vision kind of unfolded into a championship?
Well, the trades he made were unbelievable. I don't even know if clubs would make those trades now. And I mean, I love Lee Mazzilli. He's one of my closest friends. He still is. But to trade a Lee Mazzilli for Walt Terrell and Ron Darling, two guys who are going to be top of the rotation guys, who are on the brink of getting to the big leagues. We're not talking about guys who are 19 years old and A-ball. I mean, Ron, we made that trade in 82. And by 83, he was in the big leagues. And I think Walt came up in 84. And then, the Keith Hernandez trade, really, I think it was the thing that set us over the top. I mean, we went from a good club at the beginning of 84 because we had him. We would have been a good club because we had him. We became a contender.
Obviously, there's so much in the game today that wasn't there in terms of front offices, how they look at things, analytics. But why do you think trades like that got made more often back then than they do right now?
Well, I think back then the word prospect to those guys back then meant you strike out too much and you walk too many people. That's what the word prospect means. You're not good enough to be in the big leagues, basically. Now, I'm not talking about guys who are 18, 19 years old, but now those prospects and draft picks are like gold. And sometimes they work, sometimes they don't. I mean, and there's been, teams that have talked about, I doubt it happens, but teams talking about finishing lower in the standings so they can get a higher draft pick.
Right.
I mean, we're not the NBA and the NFL. I mean, don't think that these guys that got drafted last week, you're going to see them anytime soon. I mean, these guys got to go to A-ball and AA, and it's going to be 2 or 3 years before they get here. But for some reason, those draft picks and prospects, controllable and affordable, are the two most definitive adjectives now. So I think that's the reason why.
Everybody remembers Joe Torre as Mets manager, just getting started in his managerial career. Of course, Davey had the World Series team. But George Bamberger was in between those guys. He was a pitching coach for Earl Weaver's Orioles. What kind of impact did he have on you as a young major leaguer?
George had a huge impact on me because he was all about throwing. You know, we didn't have a lot of the strength and conditioning things that we have now. We didn't have the facility for it, and we didn't have people on our payroll. So what we did was we ran and we threw. And I tell people this, and they can't believe it. I threw a complete game in spring training in a B game. and George Bamberger, he was big on that, you know?
Yeah.
What's a complete game, by the way?
Yeah. But, and even back then, in 1985, I had 6 complete games in the big leagues with the Mets. There was one team last year in Major League Baseball that had more complete games than I did as an individual, and I stunk. So, I think Dwight had 20 that year, 19 or 20. So, yeah. But George had a huge impact because it was about running and throwing. And you know what? Running and throwing are boring and painful, and you don't want to do it. It's not sexy like going in and doing squats or doing a lot of stuff in the weight room. You don't come out of there feeling like Tarzan. You know, there's an old saying, look like Tarzan, throw like Jane, you know. So George had a huge impact on me. It was all about throwing and running. And not just jogging. I mean, you can find a 50-year-old dentist to jog. It's doing 60-yard sprints as hard as you can go and do 20 of those because it's an explosion, rest kind of thing. And I think we've gotten away from that as an industry.
What allowed you to be as successful as you were pitching the big leagues for, 7 years with stuff that
for a
wasn't
guy who stunk, as you said.
Exactly. Yeah. For someone who just had nothing. No, but you talk about, you see the guys today, and everything is about velocity. And in a lot of cases, you can make the argument, I think many who have been in the game as long as you have probably would, that guys don't know how to pitch the way that they used to.
No.
So what allowed you with a mid-80s fastball to be able to have the success that you did?
Well, I would have had a hard time now because it's all, as you said, it's all about velocity and strikeouts. And the thing that allowed me is, number one, I was never hurt. And I was available every day. And I always posted up. And I remember that year in 85. I mean, it's not like I was pitching 1-0 complete games. It was probably 10-1. So my goal was to get through the game, to win the game. It wasn't to worry about my ERA independent of fielding. You know what I mean? It's,
yeah,
it's, yeah. It seems like now the it's become is like a series of events on the field. It's almost like a decathlon. You know, we're going to win the launch angle, exit velocity, pitching velocity, spin rate, all these little events. Well, who won the game? Geez, I don't remember, but, you know, we out-exit velocity them. So everything was focused on winning the game. So what, if I'm up 10-0, the last thing I'm going to do is walk somebody.
Yeah.
Or the last thing I'm going to do is try to strike somebody out. Right. On a 2-2 pitch, we used to treat those like 3-2 pitches. I mean, you don't want to go to 3-2. Now I see guys bouncing 2-2 breaking balls. Now it's 3-2, and they walk them or the guy hits the ball hard. So I think I understood, number one, I was available all the time, and number two, I pitched in the context of the game, situational pitching, and I understood what my role was, and I was always available. So I think that's the reason I survived.
When you talk about something like that, and you know, you talk about the things that you see today with pitchers in general, do you think that in part that's why so many of the little things have seemed to go by the wayside, not just with pitching, but in general? It seems like, you know, there's less attention paid to running the bases the right way or you know, certain defensive aspects that players are not necessarily playing the game with the, not that they're not trying to win, but that the objective is not situationally, this is what we have to do to just give our team the best chance to win right now.
Oh, yeah. To me, it's obvious why. It's the old saying, follow the money. Mm-hmm. I mean, players, I was a player. I might have been dumb, but I wasn't stupid. I mean, you are being rewarded for those things that show up in the box score, show up on what they choose to analyze. I mean, if you're a young hitter now and you are 30 games out in mid-August, and your team either by behavior or they've come out and declared, we're going to tank to get high draft picks, and you got a man on second and nobody out, and you're sitting there thinking, now, if I move that guy over into scoring position with one out, my OPS goes down.
Right.
But if I try to hit a home run and I strike out, my OPS goes down the same amount, but at least I took a shot at, you know, hitting a home run.
Yeah.
So we don't reward statistically. They cannot quantify situational baseball, moving a runner over. I mean, I can't remember the last time I saw a hit and run. Mm-hmm. I really can't. And bunting has gone by the wayside. So I understand why they're doing certain things. I mean, it's okay to have one or two or three guys in the middle of your lineup doing that kind of thing. But when you have a leadoff hitter or a 7-8 hole hitter and they're shifting on them and the whole other side of the field is open and you're down a run, and they're flying out to right field, you know, on the pull side, that doesn't make much sense. So I think we need to start rewarding the kind of behavior you guys are talking about, the situational behavior that wins a game. Doesn't necessarily look sexy or doesn't make it onto, you know, the fantasy baseball type of analysis.
We have to ask you about the trade that you mentioned in June of 1986. You were dealt to the Cubs. By that year, the Cubs were out of contention. They won the division a couple years before that, but 86 was not a good year for them, like it certainly was for the Mets. As a guy who grew up in that system, saw the evolution, you know, what was it like for you to have to go somewhere else while that team was popping the champagne?
It was really difficult. You know, I'm not going to lie. I remember being close to tears when it happened. You know, I understood the business of baseball. I think I was smart enough. I mean, I had a degree before I signed in business, which probably doesn't help you emotionally with it, but I understood. And I remember I had knee surgery in April of 86, and I was getting ready to be able to pitch. I went down on a rehab assignment to pitch for Tidewater, and I'm looking at their staff in the big leagues, and back then they carried 10 pitchers. Mm-hmm. And Rick Aguilera was the 10th man on the staff. Mm-hmm. So right then I realized, there's no way I'm going to bump him. So, you know, in retrospect, I look at it. If I never got traded to the Cubs, I probably would have never been the general manager of the Cubs.
Yeah,
so
right.
I try
yeah.
to see the positive side of it. But I understood it perfectly, you know, why they did it, and I would have done the same thing. It was hard to swallow. It really was.
Do you, in the moment, I mean, obviously when you're removed from it, you probably think of it and view it differently, but are you sitting there rooting for them to win the World Series, or is there?
Yeah, I knew I was going to get a half share. No, of course I was. I wasn't going to say, hey, they'll never win it without me. I wasn't that stupid. But you know what's funny about that? I think I pitched an inning for the Mets that year, and I started against them, and I think in August of that year, against Dwight Gooden in Wrigley Field. And, you know, we were 100 games out, and they were 20 games up, and I remember coming up to the plate. I was hitting my first at-bat, and Gary Carter's catching. And I said to Gary, you know, I'm coming up to hit. Dwight's pitching. I said, hey, I heard this guy's got a pretty good fastball. He goes, you want to see it? I said, yeah. So I didn't even see the ball. I was a horrible hitter. So I got two strikes, and I go, hey, I heard he's got a good curveball. He goes, you want to see it? So he puts down, I think I looked as he put down two, and I went, oh, no, strike three. And I was out. But, you know, I pitched for that team and pitched against that team, and that was a good team. I mean, you talk about guys that understood situational baseball, how to play it, how to do the little things to win.
We know that Gary Carter was a great hitting catcher, but what was it like to pitch to him? Was he on a different level from that standpoint, too, as a guy to work with?
Well, he was great. And people asked me, who was, you know, the favorite catcher you ever pitched to? And I said, Gary Carter. And they said, well, did he call a good game? Did he block pitches? I said, no, he hit a three-run homer every time I pitched. But he was a, you know, you had to work with Gary. You know, he would listen. I mean, when he first came over, he used to set up, I don't know if you remember, he'd set up right down the middle like this. Mm-hmm. And that's okay if you throw 100 miles an hour.
Yeah.
But I had to work the corners, sink, cut, change up, back door, all that little stuff. And I said, kid, you know, so one day I came in and I got a piece of leather before he got there, and I tied it around his glove and I tied it around his mask. I said, hey, kid, I got a new invention. Put your mask on and just put your hand in. He goes, and, you know, the thing about him, he didn't get mad. He said, am I like that? Am I like that? And I said, yeah, you are with me. And he goes, okay, I'll do my best. And I said, can you call more breaking balls with guys on base? Uh-huh. And this is what he said to me, and people would laugh. He said, okay, I'll do that. But you have to get your release time under 1.3 for me to do that. Yeah. And I said, hey, you got a deal. Because yeah. Bamberger had taught me a slide step, okay, you know, so I was under one, basically. No one ever ran on me. Number one, because I couldn't strike him out. But number two, I was so quick to the plate, and Gary loved that. Yeah. He loved it. And but they would hit and run all the time on me.
Did you, as much as you, you know, you talk about communicating with Gary Carter, Keith was a unique guy in that he would come over all the time and talk to us. But did you like that? Was that something you enjoyed out of Keith?
Yeah,
or where you said, get back to first?
Well, there's an infielder who will remain anonymous who was not allowed to be on the mound anymore. We banned him from being on the mound, the pitchers. And we said, okay, Keith's the only guy that come over. And when Keith came over, he said something important and topical. He wasn't just trying to get on television, you know.
Surprisingly. Yeah. I mean, it sounds like that's exactly what he would
want. You look at pitching changes now. I'm surprised the outfielders don't come into the mound now. It's like you have the entire infield there. And
well, you better get your money's worth. You only got six of them.
That's right. That's right. So, but Keith was our leader. And, you know, the thing about Keith is he led by example. But, for instance, if I didn't get a bunt down, like if there was a situation where I needed to get a sacrifice bunt down, if I didn't get it down, Davey wouldn't say anything. Keith would be waiting for me on the top step.
Wow.
Just he was our leader. He was he's the best player I ever played with. I can say that without hesitation.
I know you mentioned it earlier that when he came, that changed everything for
yes.
the organization. Obviously, his skills, like you talked about, you know, best player you've ever played with, were superior, but. Do championship teams need a guy like that to come in and just change the culture as
Absolutely.
Well?
Absolutely. Yeah. The biggest difference for me between bad teams and good teams, when you lose a game as a bad team, it's like, well, you know what? We gave it our best shot, and, hey, we battled them, and, you know, they were just, you know, we lost, you know. When you're on a championship caliber team, every loss is a personal insult, and someone's going to pay. Mm-hmm. If you screwed up in the field or you didn't get a bunt down, you're going to hear about it. I mean, it's a personal affront to you as a man when you lose games when you're on a good club. Mm-hmm. And you've got to have that mentality. Losing is not acceptable. It is not acceptable. And it certainly wasn't with Keith as our leader. It was not acceptable. It was, you know, you saw some of the extracurricular things that went on there because yeah. Keith would get in guys right in their grill and tell them what he thought. And they needed to hear it. And sometimes you just take it, and some other times you lash out. So you've got to get to the point where you realize it's a war out there. It's not a war of individual statistical categories. It's a war to win the frickin' game. That's what it is.
I know it was a pretty chippy team overall.
that's
chippy.
The kind way of saying it.
That's a good word, man.
You guys had, you know, you were involved in a couple of scuffles when you were on the mound.
Absolutely.
There was an incident with Mariano Duncan. There's one with the Cubs, I think.
Yeah, with Keith Moreland, yeah.
Yeah. You know, what? When that happened, was that a bonding experience in any way for you guys?
Yeah, I mean, you know, if somebody threw at one of our guys, I was going to make sure that I let them know that that's not acceptable. And it's, I don't care if it's an accident. It still hurts our guys as much. You know, if they accidentally get hit in the elbow and are out 6 weeks, that still hurts. That hurts us. So I guess I was labeled not the headhunter, because I never intentionally tried to hit anybody above the waist. Never, ever. But I could throw a pitch right here. You know, I remember I used to, you know, we hated the Cardinals and the Cardinals hated us. And with my stuff, I couldn't just throw 100 miles an hour low and away and, here, guys, hit that, you know?
Right.
I had to back them up and then change speeds. And, you know, I remember one night in St. Louis, you know, Terry Pendleton, who wore me out, I said, I've had enough. So I threw a pitch right here, knocked him down, and he started yelling. And Frank Pulley, the umpire, came out and warned me. And I said, what are you warning me for, Frank? Well, you tried to hit him. I said, I tried to hit him? Go back there and next pitch, I'll show you what happens when I try to hit him. And he says, don't do it, Eddie. And I didn't do it. But, you know, I could pitch 3 inches off the belt buckle or off the breastbone. I had to do that. I wasn't trying to hit you. And my command was good enough where I wouldn't hit you. But guys just didn't like it because it made them feel uncomfortable.
How do you develop that command? I mean, how do you develop such pinpoint accuracy? And, you know, your brother, he never played in the majors, but he was drafted in the third round by the Mets. So clearly, the two of you growing up.
Wow, you did your homework. Yeah.
I mean, listen.
Well, he was 19 months.
We don't ask you on the podcast unless we know what we're talking about.
Well, you know, it's funny you bring that up because he was 19 months older than me, but because I was so tall, I was in the grade behind him. So I was always very young for my grade. But in the backyard growing up, he would catch and I would pitch and vice versa. And you get to pitch until you walk somebody. And then you had to catch. You know, he'd want to catch, so you try to go as long as you can without walking somebody. But it's very simple. The word command, if you look, the word command is misused. I ask a lot of young pitchers, what does the word command mean? Not walking people. No. Command is throwing the ball where you're aiming, mm-hmm. Okay? Every time you throw anything, if you're throwing a baseball, playing catch in the outfield, certainly on the mound, throwing a piece of paper into a trash can, you are aiming at a spot about this big. Yep. Okay, aim small, miss small. If you're aiming big, you miss big. So command, I think they're trying to maximize velocity. So you need to find that level of effort where you can hit that spot 9 times out of 10. Now, if you want to throw it harder, you start at a baseline where you can hit that spot 9 times out of 10, and then slowly, incrementally increase your effort level until you lose that spot. You can't hit that spot anymore. Then you back down into an effort level where you can maximize your effort and still hit that spot. But I see now max effort, guys throwing the ball as hard as they can every pitch. And there's no way you can command your pitches if you do that.
When you became a general manager, what was that transition like for you to go work into the front office and then become a guy who's in charge of a team and in charge of having to be making all these decisions?
It's a tough job, let's face it. It's a very difficult job. And, you know, the one thing that people don't talk about, you know, I'll see all the time on television, they'll say, well, what are the things about the game you would change? And people talk about shifts and September call-ups. But the one thing we haven't addressed is the disparity in revenues between the highest and the lowest. Mm-hmm. I mean, you have Tampa Bay trying to compete with the New York Yankees. And as a GM with a team with not a lot of money, you don't have a lot of options, you know, and that's why injuries are devastating to you. I mean, to lose a guy like Cespedes, you know, other clubs that choose to spend money just throw a ton of money at it, and it makes them look smarter than they are, and it's not. I mean, it's a very difficult job because you're trying to maximize the effect of the dollars that you have, and you're trying to build depth, and you're trying to manage your roster in such a way that you're not putting all your resources in one position and ignoring the other. So it's a very difficult job.
I think people that are listening to you say that about the Cubs, they're like, wait, what are you talking about? The Cubs spend a lot of money. When they were owned by the Chicago Tribune, that was not the case. You were probably on a pretty tight budget for that.
Well,
team
back in those days, I got the job during the strike. So coming out of the strike, if you think about the Cubs in those days, all their broadcasts were on WGN TV and WGN Radio. And we we were all in the same company. So we gave them that product at very, very reduced prices. I mean, almost laughably low prices. Mm-hmm. We had no signage in Wrigley Field, no parking. So if you think about it, we were the third largest market and probably 15th or 16th in revenues.
Yeah.
So it was a very deceptive thing. People were like, well, you're in the third largest market, you should be spending the most amount of money. And we just didn't have the revenues to support that. And you can see by the clubs that I had to, you know, we were probably mid-range in payroll. And plus I was paying Sammy Sosa a lot of money, and he was taking a significant percentage of that money that was available.
Was there a moment when you took the job early on where, obviously you know how daunting it's going to be, but where it kind of hit you, where something happened and you said, oh, this is an aspect I didn't even really think about before?
No, I was trained pretty well. You know, Joe McElvain hired me in San Diego as the farm director. I was there in 91, 2, and 3, and I was with him all the time in his office every night before and after games. And I understood the problems that come with it. And then he went to New York, and I went with him as the assistant into, you know, the biggest market, and that was good training, you know. The media is a very challenging part of the job, very, very challenging part of the job. But it's a necessary part of the job.
When they don't do their research like we do.
When they know about my brother, that's pretty impressive. Let me tell you something. But, yeah, you know, it can be scary at times because you have a feeling sometimes that no matter what you do, it's wrong. And when you're going out and you're talking to the media and you can't lie and you can't tell the truth, good luck. Go get them, you know. And so you wind up, you know, why didn't you sign Randy Johnson as a free agent? And the reason is the Tribune at that time wasn't willing to make that financial commitment. Mm-hmm. I'm okay with that. They were very honest. So I get in front of the media, and why didn't you sign Randy Johnson? Well, I felt if we were one player away, Randy be the kind of guy and blah, blah, blah. And you sound like the village idiot, frankly. But you can't really come out and say, well, I would love to sign him, but I couldn't get the money from ownership.
Right,
that's suicide,
right.
You know?
The Cubs did make the playoffs in 1998, and a key trade to help you guys get there was actually made the year before, I believe, in August with the Mets. You had Lance Johnson and Mark Clark come over. You traded Turk Wendell and Brian McRae. There were some big names involved in that deal, and it was after the trade deadline. What was the genesis of that trade, and how did you go about working with the Mets on that?
Well, that's a long time ago, but, you know, it was different back then. I mean, literally after the after the waiver deadline, after July 31st, nowadays you could never, players, unless they're making a bazillion dollars and they're underachieving, someone's going to claim them and block the trade. Back in those days, I can remember Ron Shuler of the White Sox calling me. I was trying to get a player through to trade him. And I called him up and said, you know, hey, Ron, you know, I hear you might claim, can you let him through so I can trade him? He says, yeah, just don't trade him in my division. I said, I won't. You know, and there was, but then the Denny Nagel thing happened. Denny Nagel, no one claimed him, and he got traded from Pittsburgh to Atlanta and helped them win the division. And everybody's like, well, how does he get available?
Right.
And then the next year, you had like a record number of claims. I think Steve Phillips claimed like 112 guys one year or something. No, I'm not joking. I mean, look it up. So, I mean, the genesis of that trade was we had contracts. They weren't marquee-type players. Their contracts were significant enough where people weren't just going to claim them on the chance they might get them. You know, it wasn't, you know, earth-moving trade, but it was just, you know, a trade that worked for both sides, money-wise and player-wise.
Have you ever, either before or after, been around a guy that's even close to as superstitious as Turk Wendell?
Well, I haven't been around Turk, but I heard about the toothbrush stuff and all that. But I think every player is got a certain amount of superstition. God forbid, don't get a haircut on the day you're starting. I mean, that was one that. But I think most players have some sort of superstition. I really do. Yeah.
We have a tradition before we let you go here. Your favorite Jay Horowitz story.
You know, Jay and I came to the Mets at the same time, 1980. I came in September of 79. I came up to the big leagues, and I was talking to him the other day. He joined in April 1st, 1980. There's just so many of them, but I remember one day we're walking down the concourse, and he used to carry this big square bag, and he's walking along, and he's got nothing but the handle in his hand. And I said, Jay, where's your bag? He's like, I got it right. Oh, you look like 100 yards down. There's his bag sitting there with no handle on it. He's carrying a handle and didn't even realize it.
And that right there is why it's a tradition.
That's right.
That's why it's a tradition. Ed Lidge, this was great. We could talk to you for 3 hours. This is so much fun. Thank you so much for doing
this. Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you.
Our thanks to Ed Lynch for doing that. He did that when we were in Arizona,
yeah,
actually.
It was a while ago.
Yeah, that's where he lives right now. I thought there were so many really interesting points and interesting stories from that interview. For me, you know, I loved hearing about Keith, obviously, and what he brought. You know, he said Keith was the best player that he'd ever played with.
Yeah.
But also the story about Gary Carter.
He didn't give much love to Gary Carter, did he?
Well, he
as far
you know,
as a defensive player.
He said that he didn't work with his pitchers necessarily. He just put the glove right in the center.
Yeah.
But I love that story where he attached that piece of leather from Gary Carter's mask to the glove. Yeah. He says, hey, you don't even need to worry about it.
And the whole point was that it didn't matter what Gary Carter caught because he would just smash a 3-run homer.
Right.
And as we learned, we talked about it earlier in our softball game, we learned that home runs really matter.
Yeah, that is, you know, we didn't talk about that before introing the Ed Lynch interview while discussing our softball issues today. But, you know, for all the people talking about small ball, and we've kind of been on that.
Small ball's cool.
Hey, small ball's great. We could not string together many singles, and the front office, they hit bombs.
Yeah.
And they killed us. So
to Ed Lynch's point, 3-run homers are good.
Yeah. He also did talk about liking small ball, though. So, you know, you got to have a mix.
He had Sammy Sosa on his teams when he was a GM. There wasn't much small ball going on there. Let me just tell you that.
Wayne, do you want to say who's on the next podcast? Are we doing
that? Next podcast is going to be a good one. Yeah, we should tell people.
All the podcasts have been good ones. Okay,
this will be a good one.
Okay, good.
I didn't say that doesn't mean the other ones weren't.
No, but the way you said it was in that next podcast is going to be as if the first three haven't been magic.
Not.
Okay,
no.
Which they have.
Next one will be a good one.
Uh-huh.
Because they're all good ones. And it's going to be Todd Frazier.
Todd
Frazier himself.
Flavor Frazier, the Todd father.
And, of course, the purpose of this is to get out in front of the Little League World Series. The Mets are playing in the Little League Classic, and it'll be Todd's first trip to Williamsport since then, Tom's River.
20 years. Rain Delay Theater, Episode 3, it's in the books. And I'm sorry, I messed it up again. You say it. Go.
Rain Delay Theater.
The podcast. Thank you, as always, for listening. Again, a huge, huge amount of appreciation coming from us for how receptive you guys have been early on. Keep listening, and we will see you next week.